Welcome to this lecture on politics in East Asia. My name is Pekka Korhonen and I work as a professor of world politics in University of Jyväskylä. And these lectures are meant for the Finnish National University Network for East and Southeast Asian Studies. And now it's December 2012. The composition of these lectures will be, first we will take a look at what does the concept of East Asia mean. The actors that will appear in these lectures will be states and humans. Many of these humans will be politicians. Sometimes they may also be youth, sometimes mothers, because these will not be purely political science lectures. I will use also economics, and sometimes also sociology, especially demography, to highlight different aspects in East Asia. And we will take a look also at narratives, because narratives are in the center of politics. How do you define and discuss and argue about things? Most of these lectures will be mine, but I will be also helped by three friends who will appear here and there to highlight specific things. And let's go to see at the concept of East Asia. Because most of my listeners will be Europeans, it may be good for them to free their mind or the idea that Urals can be understood as the boundary between Europe and Asia. Because if we think of Urals as the boundary, then we might think that East Asia might be somewhere here, and we might have somewhere here Northern Asia, Southern Asia here, and Western Asia here. Of course, this is not the matter. We use language differently. The reason why small children all over the world are being taught that Ural is an important boundary between Europe and Asia is this book written by Philip Johan Strahlenberg, a Swedish officer, published in 1730, Das Nord und Östliche Teil von Europa und Asia. And he got the idea, quite probably, from a Russian geographer, Vasily Nikitich Tatishchev. And the reason why we got into this kind of thought was that during the 16th, 17th centuries, in many, if not all, but at least in many European maps, the boundary between Europe and Asia was drawn here. Basically, the river Dnieper, starting on the Black Sea and then going to the Lake Ladoga, and then the White Sea and to the Polar Sea. And when Peter the First started to Europeanize Russia, he wanted to take his country out of Asia to Europe. And redefining the boundary to Urals made two things simultaneously. It brought Russia from Asia to Europe, and simultaneously it created a situation where Russia had colonies, namely Siberia, in the eastern side of the Urals. In the same way that the Netherlands or Britain, France, and other big, great European powers also had colonies in Asia. And for some reason or another, this is the definition that later went to European schoolbooks and all over the world is studying this thing at school. But this has nothing to do with contemporary world politics, where definitions are quite different. When we move towards the present time, the 19th century, Russia was quite normally not considered as a nation power. It was an area of its own. And in normal political and geographic and cultural also language, when you talked about Asia, you used this kind of divisions. And East Asia, that is the main thing today in these lectures, was composed of basically China, Korea, and Japan. It was considered as important cultural center of its own. Then we had South Asia, centered in India, which also was considered as a cultural center of its own. Geographically, and also in terms of population and so on, religion and so on, there was also another area which was south from East Asia and east from South Asia. It became to be called Southeast Asia. Sometimes all this area was also called Far East, but that is not the term that we use nowadays. Western Asia was used during the 19th century, early 20th century also. As well as Central Asia, but nowadays West Asia is extremely seldom used. And Central Asia is something that was taken again into usage after the Cold War, when the word needed to be, when the concept was needed, to name these new independent republics that were no more parts of the Soviet Union. We often still use these concepts of East Asia and South Asia in the old way. And much of these lectures will also be concentrated on China, Korea, and Japan, simply because I know most of them. And also the other reason being that, they are the biggest powers in this area. But these processes of naming tend to go on always. In 1986, Japanese foreign minister, who is the father of the probable future Prime Minister of Japan, started to call Southeast Asian countries also East Asia, because East Asia had more prestige, and he wanted to integrate these Southeast Asian countries more towards Japan. He started to rename them. So nowadays, what used to be called East Asia is sometimes called Northeast Asia, as a distinction between Southeast Asia. For a long time, South Asia remained as South Asia, but also in that case, the situation is no more so easy. George Lakoff's and Mark Johnson's book, Metaphors with Dubai, for instance, is a good theoretical book about the change of names through time. And whatever concept we have, whatever especially geographical name we have, especially if it's connected with politics, you tend to see change through sometimes decades, sometimes centuries. But these special names are always on the move. East Asia is also expanding. because East Asia is today the most economically dynamic region of the world. It's expanding economically, and economic expansion creates also political and conceptual expansion. Just like Europe, European Union used to expand to the 1990s, the first decade of this millennium, new countries being added to the European Union. Also Asia is expanding, and East Asia expanding nowadays. Countries that are named nowadays within Asia, and Asia and East Asia tend to become synonymous with each other. At least it contains affluent countries, like Japan or Korea, are easily understood as Asian countries nowadays. Miracle Asia is the most interesting aspect here. What defines Asia nowadays is rapid economic growth at one part of the history of the modern states. And especially if a country is able to attain an economic growth of annually 7.2%. It shows great dynamism. Because if you go continue with a growth rate by 7.2%, in 10 years, your size will become twice of the size where you started. And most of these East Asian countries have been able to achieve this high growth rates. Then there are places that are being named as Asia. For some reason, politically, culturally, economically, there's some kind of reason to engage into regional cooperation. And so these countries can be named there. Australia, New Zealand used to be considered as outposts of Europe. All the way until the 1970s, 1980s. But nowadays they are considered as Asian countries in international organizations. And also in international statistics, like, let's say, IMF nowadays places Australia and New Zealand into the category of Asia. They were used to move from Europe into Asia because they were affluent countries. And basically, theoretically, as the Asian expansion goes on, any place on Earth can be in the future called Asia, even European Union. But that is a time that is still far away in the future, probably. The old continents, Europe, Asia, Africa, America, well, America doesn't so much belong here. They are being renamed in this kind of naming processes. The Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in its Blue Book in 1990, first published this kind of map, which, however, is edited by me, dividing the old world into five specific areas. One is Europe here, and one is Asia here. The former Soviet Union, nowadays Russia, and the states that were separated from it, compose one specific continental area. The Islamic area, that used to, part of which used to be called Western Asia earlier, and Northern Africa, it forms one continent, and then the rest of Africa forms the fifth one. This is the way big areas are now being defined in world politics. Where the boundaries lie is debatable, but these are rough estimations of that. India used to be, for a long time, in South Asia, as part of Asia. But in 2005, 7 years ago from now, a new international organization was created called the East Asian Summit. The first meeting was held in Kuala Lumpur, and since then they have had meetings almost annually. They are very important meetings where heads of state, presidents or prime ministers of each of these states meet, discuss regional things. So India entered East Asia at this time. And since last year, when Russia and the United States also joined the East Asian Summit, we can say that also USA is now an East Asian country, and also Russia, meaning that East Asia starts from the eastern boundary of Finland. Of course, this meaning is extremely thin, but yet it is a meaning. And the outer boundary of my lectures will largely deal with this area. Its center will be in China, Korea, and Japan, but the Southeast Asia will also be taken quite often into the picture. Also Australia, New Zealand sometimes. USA will be in the background of things most of the time. Russia and India will appear sometimes, but not so often. I would also like to show you some graph. We are here. This graph is called the Gapminder graph. On this line, we have income per person calculated in purchasing power parities, adjusted to inflation and in dollar terms. And here, we have life expectancy. So this graph describes all the states of the world in terms of relative wealth, and the life expectancy is also a very good measure of the quality of life in specific countries. And we must take a look at 200 years of human history. We start here, in the beginning of the 19th century, when all states of the world and all the whole humankind, both here in the left and lower hand corner, quite poor, not living long. So this is the beginning. These orange balls define European states. They used to be a bit ahead of the others, but not very much. This big red ball is China. It's not far behind the Western countries. This here is India. And most African states are here. Green ones means Islamic states. And so on. Orange ones are European ones, and red ones are American states. So let's go and play it. Time goes on, and European states start to advance quite rapidly. China is an interesting place. India also, India goes down. China also tends to go backwards. might stop here. Around the end of the Second World War, we are in a world where European states are the rulers of the earth. Life expectancy, even though we have a war, is quite high, and they are very rich, clearly ahead of the others. United States is already the most wealthy and the most powerful state on earth. Australia, New Zealand are here also in a very good position. And Islamic states and African states are here far behind all them. Japan is almost the sole Asian state that has been able to advance well in riches, although life expectancy at wartime is quite low. Singapore is a bit higher than it. All other states are trailing behind. In the post-war situation, you saw rapid movement. The whole humankind starts progressing upward. And the movement still goes on and on and on. We are here in year 2011. No state is here in the left lower hand corner. They are all now much upwards. Even African states are much more affluent, much more well governed than European states used to be 200 years ago. What we now have here in the upper hand corner, mostly Western European states, USA is there, Japan is there at the highest position, Hong Kong, China, Singapore. Macau in China is now almost the richest place on earth, with Qatar competing with it. The rest of humankind is coming back. Trailing behind. But the differences are not very big, and these countries here move much farther than these early European states. So we are approaching slowly a situation where the whole humankind is on a similar level of welfare. It will take another 100 years until African states also come to that level. But that can be seen nowadays. This is an extremely interesting graph. You can find it easily in the internet when you put Gapminder into Google or some other search engine. And it is free for anybody to use, also for me in this lecture, whenever needed. So we are dealing, when we deal with East Asia, countries that are either very affluent or rapidly becoming so. Okay, and this is the end of the introduction to this lecture.